Historical What Ifs. Historical What Ifs.
History hinges on moments so small they could fit in the palm of your hand, yet their consequences echo through centuries and shape the world we live in today. This is Historical What Ifs, where we explore the alternate timelines that could have emerged from a single different decision, a missed opportunity, or a stroke of luck that went the other way. Today's episode examines one of those pivotal moments and traces the extraordinary chain of events that might have followed if history had taken just one small turn in a different direction. Welcome to Historical What Ifs, reimagining pivotal moments. Historical What Ifs.
I am so excited for this one. I've always been fascinated by the sheer velocity of the Meiji Restoration. The idea that a nation could transform itself from a feudal, isolated society into a global industrial power in a single generation. It's just mind-boggling.
It really is. For me, it's always felt like one of history's most dramatic turning points. You have this incredible tension, centuries of tradition, the samurai class, a society sealed off from the world. And then suddenly, the floodgates open. It's the ultimate story of a world changing overnight.
But that's the story we all know. Today, we're flipping the script entirely.
Exactly. We're asking a question that I think changes the entire landscape of the 19th and 20th centuries.
What if the Tokugawa shogunate weathered the storm? What if Japan pushed back against the encroaching West and successfully remained isolated?
An unseen dynasty, continuing its reign in solitude. How does that silence from Japan echo across the globe? What kind of world do we live in without the Japan we know today?
The possibilities are vast and, frankly, a little daunting to consider. It's a timeline I can't wait to explore.
And I think the first domino that has to fall, or in our case, not fall, is that initial, chaotic explosion of anti-foreign sentiment. It wasn't a unified movement. It was messy. You had these lower-ranking samurai, the shishi, these men of high purpose, who were just incandescent with rage.
Right. And they weren't all on the same page. The popular image is this united front against the shogun, but the reality was so much more fractured. You had extremists in Choshu, for instance, who were ready to march on Kyoto and force the emperor's hand, completely against the advice of more moderate leaders like Takasugi Shinsaku.
And that impulsiveness backfired spectacularly. The Hamaguri Gate Rebellion in 1864, it was a disaster for them. They get crushed.
A total political failure. And what's fascinating is who helps the shogunate crush them. It's Satsuma, the very domain that will later become their greatest ally.
I mean, can you imagine that? Saigo Takamori, this giant of the Restoration, is leading Satsuma forces with the shogunate to punish Choshu. They were mortal enemies. The idea of them working together would have been laughable in 1864.
So that's a key pivot point right there. In our alternate timeline, does that animosity just fester? Does Satsuma help the shogunate completely dismantle Choshu, removing one of the key anti-Tokugawa players from the board entirely?
It's a huge possibility. The shogunate certainly wanted to. But what actually happened was this strange mix of pragmatism and shifting priorities. Within Choshu, the hardliners are ousted. The moderates, people like Kido Takayoshi, take over and they pivot.
They shift from Son no joy, revere the emperor, expel the barbarian, to something far more practical.
Exactly. To Fukoku Kyohei.
Enrich the country, strengthen the military. They realize, we can't fight the West by closing ourselves off. We have to beat them at their own game. So they start trying to import foreign weapons, to open ports for trade, not out of friendship, but out of a desire for survival and strength.
And while Choshu is having this internal revolution in thought, Satsuma is having its own. Saigo starts to see that the real threat isn't Choshu's radicalism, but the shogunate's incompetence and its increasing coziness with the French. He sees the shogun trying to build a centralized state with foreign help, and that terrifies him.
He realizes the shogun is becoming the very thing they all feared. A puppet of foreign powers.
Which puts them in an impossible position. The two strongest domains in Japan, Choshu and Satsuma, both see the shogunate as the primary problem, but they hate each other's guts. They can't talk. They can't cooperate.
Until a certain someone steps in. A masterless samurai. A merchant. An idealist.
Sakamoto Ryoma.
He's the ultimate broker. He's not tied to the rigid politics of either domain. He sees the bigger picture and uses his business connections in Nagasaki to essentially launder weapons for Choshu from the British, using Satsuma's name to bypass the shogunate's embargo.
It's geopolitical maneuvering at its finest, conducted by a guy who's technically a nobody. He physically brings Saigo and Kido, these two titans who despise each other, into a room.
And on March 7th, 1866, the unthinkable happens. The Satcho Alliance, a secret pact between mortal enemies to overthrow the government. Without that alliance, none of what follows is possible. The whole house of cards stays standing.
So let's pause on that image for a second. The Satcho Alliance exists, but it's a secret. It's a piece of paper. In our alternate timeline, all it takes is one person to get cold feet, one assassination, and Ryoma is assassinated not long after, for that whole thing to just evaporate.
Or for the shogun to get his act together. And that's the tragedy of the last shogun, Tokugawa Yoshinobu. He wasn't some bumbling fool. He was sharp. He was a reformer. He was already trying to modernize the shogunate's army with French help. He saw the writing on the wall.
And he makes this incredibly savvy political move. In late 1867, he voluntarily returns governing authority to the emperor. It's called the Taisei Hokan.
It's a brilliant gambit. On the surface, it looks like he's conceding everything. He's saying, you want the emperor to have power? Fine, here you go.
But what he's really doing is pulling the rug out from under Satsuma and Choshu. Their entire justification for war is to restore the emperor. Well, Yoshinobu just did it for them. His plan, his hope, was that in the new government that would form, he, as the head of the most powerful clan in Japan, would simply be made a sort of prime minister. He'd retain all the real power.
He tries to preempt their revolution by staging his own, more moderate one. But Saigo and the others, they see right through it. They know this is just a reshuffling of the deck.
Oh, they are not having it. Not for a second. So they respond with an even bolder move. They stage a coup. They get a few sympathetic court nobles. They surround the imperial palace in Kyoto with their troops. And they have the young Emperor Meiji, who's what, 15 at this point, issue a rescript.
An imperial restoration edict. And this edict doesn't just accept power back. It explicitly abolishes the office of shogun and orders the Tokugawa clan to surrender all of its lands. It's a total checkmate.
It's an absolute declaration of war, politically speaking. Yoshinobu has been completely outmaneuvered. He retreats from Kyoto to his castle in Osaka, and his followers are, they're incandescent with rage. They feel he's been tricked, that the emperor is being held hostage by these traitors from Satsuma and Choshu.
And this is where it all goes from a political chess match to a real bloody war. The shogunate forces, vastly outnumbering the Satcho army, march on Kyoto to, in their minds, free the emperor.
And they meet at Toba Fushimi, just south of the city. And this is where the symbolism becomes everything. The Satsuma and Choshu forces aren't just fighting as rebels. They've managed to secure the official imperial brocade banner. They are, officially, the Emperor's army.
Can you imagine being a Tokugawa samurai? You've been raised your entire life to be loyal to both the shogun and the emperor. And now you're being ordered to fire on the emperor's own flag. It must have been a moment of profound, paralyzing crisis.
It completely shatters their morale. They have better numbers, but the Satchel forces have modern Armstrong guns, and more importantly, they have this unshakable legitimacy. Some of the domains that were allied with the Shogun just freeze. One of them actually switches sides mid-battle when they see the Imperial banner.
And that's the ballgame right there. Yoshinobu, hearing of the defeat and, crucially, that the Imperial banner has been deployed against him, loses his nerve. He flees Osaka on a ship, heading for Edo. The moment he does that, he ceases to be a credible leader. The Boshin War will drag on, but the Shogunate, as a political entity, is finished.
But that single decision, Yoshinobu's flight from Osaka, it's one of those moments where you just want to scream at the historical record. In our alternate timeline, if he doesn't lose his nerve, if he stands his ground, rallies his forces at his home base in Edo, this is an entirely different conflict.
It becomes a true civil war. Not a relatively short campaign, but a brutal, protracted struggle that could last for years. The Satchel forces had the momentum and the modern rifles, sure. But the Tokugawa still had immense resources, a vast number of loyal retainers, and the entire machinery of the state, at least in the East.
And what happens to a nation embroiled in a long civil war in the mid-19th century?
Foreign powers start picking sides. It's inevitable.
Exactly. You have the French already advising the Shogunate. The British were sympathetic to Satsuma and Choshu. You start to see a very real possibility of Japan being carved up into spheres of influence. A French-backed Tokugawa state in the east, a British-backed imperial state in the west.
And Japan becomes a proxy battleground. The very nightmare scenario that all those Sonnojoey samurai were fighting to prevent becomes a self-fulfilled prophecy. Their inability to win decisively dooms the entire country to the fate of so many other nations at the time.
And so the unseen dynasty of the Tokugawa continues, but as a shadow, a protectorate. And the global implications of that? I mean, they're almost too vast to calculate. Without a unified, rapidly industrializing Japan, the entire power dynamic of the 20th century is unrecognizable.
There's no Russo-Japanese War. That shocking moment in 1905, when an Asian power defeats a European one, a moment that inspired anti-colonial movements from India to Egypt, it just never happens. Russia's expansion into Manchuria and Korea probably continues unchecked.
Which means the pressures that led to the Russian Revolution might be different. The fate of the Qing dynasty in China, without Japan as a rival and aggressor, is completely altered. World War I, World War II, every single domino falls differently.
It's fascinating. We began this thinking about a Japan that remains feudal and isolated. But the more likely outcome of the restoration failing is the complete opposite, a total loss of sovereignty.
That's the ultimate paradox, isn't it? The Meiji Restoration, for all its internal violence and eventual imperialism, was fundamentally an act of national self-preservation. It was an incredibly risky, almost impossibly narrow path that they managed to walk, against all odds.
And our what-if shows just how easily they could have stumbled. It's a stark reminder that history isn't a foregone conclusion. It's built on these chaotic, desperate moments and individual choices. The world we know was forged in that specific fire, and without it, we're looking at a map we wouldn't even recognize. The butterfly effect of history reminds us that the world we know today is just one of countless possibilities, shaped by moments of chance, choice, and consequence that could have easily gone another way. This has been Historical What Ifs, where every episode reveals how fragile our timeline really is, and how different decisions by our ancestors might have created an entirely different present. Understanding these alternate possibilities doesn't just satisfy our curiosity. It helps us appreciate how remarkable it is that we ended up in this particular version of history.